Hello and welcome back. We are so glad you are here with us.
We really are.
Today, we are opening up a stack of notes that feels, well, honestly, it feels a little dangerous. We're looking at a Sunday night message from Brother Steve at New Life Benson.
This is lesson five in his series, and the title alone is enough to make the modern world just, incredibly uncomfortable. Judgment will come to the nations.
It is a heavy title. It really is. I mean, in 2026, judgment isn't exactly a popular buzzword.
Not at all.
We live in a culture that's all about affirmation and positivity and, live your truth. So sitting down to process a sermon about wrath and separation and unquenchable fire.
It feels completely countercultural. But as you read through what Brother Steve is teaching, you realize this isn't just fire and brimstone for the sake of it.
Ugh.
There's a deeply sophisticated theological argument here that I think believers are starving for.
That's the hook, isn't it?
It really is.
Yeah.
Because we are going to get to Matthew 25, the famous sheep and goats judgment, and I think a lot of you are going to be surprised by what the text actually says versus what we think it says.
Exactly. There's a distinction between earning heaven and inheriting heaven that just it fits the whole script.
That distinction is the key to everything. It changes how you view your salvation completely.
But before we get into the heavy theology, we have to ground this. I mean, we're not in a lecture hall.
Right.
We're in a church family in Benson. And I love the way Brother Steve opens the service because it reminds you, these are real people. Right off the bat, he's got this announcement about the Christian Cowboy Ministries of Arizona.
I loved that detail. It paints such a vivid picture of the community.
It really does. They're holding church services at rodeos. Then you have the baby bottle drive for the four-week care ministry. It feels very grounded.
And then you get his personality.
Oh, yeah. Did you catch the bit about the fast food?
The Jack in the Box comment, that made me laugh out loud.
He's talking about the church group going out to eat, and he says they need to go to Jack in the Box specifically to get Jack out of the box.
Because the poor guy's been in there for decades.
He says he's concerned for Jack's sanity. It's this sort of dry dad joke humor that really disarms you. It makes you realize Brother Steve's isn't some angry prophet on a mountain. He's a pastor who loves his people, and apparently, a good burger.
But I think that humor serves a really specific purpose. It lowers your defenses.
It has to.
Because immediately after the jokes, the tone shifts dramatically. When you look at the prayer requests, that's where the rubber meets the road.
It is. And this is why I think this message on judgment is so necessary for this specific group.
Yeah.
They're not living easy lives. They're dealing with what he calls a dark world.
Take Cindy Mason, for example. The prayer request mentioned she fell off a ladder in Texas.
Right.
And Steve makes this observation that there is a time in life when ladders become a dangerous instrument.
It's a small comment, but it speaks to frailty. It speaks to the fact that our physical bodies are just temporary. One slip and everything can change.
But then it gets much heavier. There was one prayer request that really stuck with me.
For Sarah Woodman.
Yes. The notes mention she's in their Sunday school class, but she wasn't there that night. She usually sits in the back corner.
Because she's working.
Mm.
and she is not working a desk job. She's a police officer in Tucson.
And Steve specifically says she's working in homicide.
Just pause on that for a second. Think about the spiritual weight of that.
Yeah.
You spend your days dealing with the absolute worst of human nature.
Murder, violence, the aftermath of evil. That's her reality.
And it gets even heavier because the notes mention her husband is in the Border Patrol.
And he's waiting to be deployed to Minneapolis. And here's the kicker. The source notes that he is not a believer. That's a heavy burden. So you have a woman seeing death and evil at her job, worrying about her husband's safety, and carrying the spiritual weight of knowing he doesn't share her eternal hope.
When you view the sermon through Sarah Widman's eyes, the topic of judgment changes, doesn't it?
Completely.
It stops being some scary theological concept and it starts being a question of justice. If you're a homicide detective, you need to know that there's a judge who will eventually set things right.
That's a really profound way to put it. A God without judgment is a God who doesn't actually care about the victims of homicide.
So, with that weight on our shoulders, let's get into the message. Brother Steve opens lesson five by making this fascinating distinction between the Old Testament and the New Testament.
He does. He argues that the type of judgment changes.
And I hadn't really thought about it this way before.
He points out that if you look at the Old Testament, the judgments are primarily temporal.
Okay, so let's break that down. Temporal just means like related to time or
Yeah,
earthly, right?
exactly. In the Old Testament, judgment is visible, it's physical. Nations are destroyed, kings are overthrown, the flood, Sodom and Gomorrah. It's about losing your physical life or your kingdom.
It focuses on our existence here.
Right.
Okay, so then you flip to the New Testament, and suddenly the Roman Empire isn't being, you know, burned down with fire from heaven.
Huh.
The bad guys, like Caesar, seem to live long lives.
Exactly. And Skinner argues that's because the focus shifts from temporal judgment to eternal judgment. In the New Testament, the warning isn't you're going to lose your land.
It's the wrath to come.
It's the wrath to come. It is about the second death. It's about the soul.
Now, he does mention there are some exceptions. We do see a little bit of that temporal judgment in the New Testament.
Sure. He brings up Herod Agrippa. Remember that story? He accepts worship as a god.
And immediately gets eaten by worms and dies. A very vivid image.
Very vivid. Or Ananias and Sapphira, who drop dead in the church for lying. But Steve's point is that those are the exceptions. The primary threat in the New Testament isn't that you'll get eaten by worms. It's that you'll face the unquenchable fire of eternity. And this leads to a fact that I think makes a lot of people really uncomfortable. Brother Steve says it plainly. Jesus taught more on hell than he did on heaven. It's a jarring statement, but it's scripturally accurate. Steve lists the descriptors Jesus used.
Outer darkness.
Weeping and gnashing of teeth. The worm that never dies.
And this is where we run into that modern objection. I hear this all the time.
Yeah.
People say, wait, I thought God was love. How can a loving God send people to a place like that?
It's the elephant in the room. And I think Brother Steve handles this beautifully. He doesn't shy away from it at all. He reframes it.
With a parenting analogy.
Yeah.
The don't touch the stove analogy.
Exactly. He asks, if you're raising a small child, do you warn them about things that are dangerous?
Of course. If my kid runs toward the street, I don't whisper. I scream.
And do you scream because you hate the child?
No, I scream because I love them and I don't want them to get hurt.
That is the point. Steve argues that if you didn't warn the child, that would be unloving. If the unquenchable fire is a reality, then the most loving thing Jesus can do is talk about it.
That perspective just, it really shifts the tone. It changes Jesus from a tyrant shouting threats into a savior shouting a warning.
It maximizes his love, actually. It does. So that sets the stage. Now we move to the main text for this lesson, Matthew 25. The context here is just so crucial.
Right.
This is the Olivet Discourse. We're talking end times. The tribulation has ended. The King Jesus is on his throne in Jerusalem.
And he gathers all the nations before him. This is the famous separation of the sheep and the goats.
And Steve brings in this great personal story here. Apparently, he and his wife Nikki lived in Greece for a while.
They did. And he says that when you get out into the countryside, you see this biblical scene just playing out in real life. The shepherds have mixed herds during the day, but in the evening, they separate them.
And there's a practical reason for it. It isn't just arbitrary. He says they don't feed well together and they don't sleep well together.
And the character description he gives is hilarious, but so accurate. He calls the sheep docile, gentle, easily led.
He even says he's a sheep of God.
Right, but the goats.
Unruly, rambunctious, fearless. They do their own thing.
It's such a clear picture of the spiritual reality. You have the sheep, the believers, who are submissive to the shepherd's voice. And you have the goats, the unbelievers, who are stubborn and independent.
And in this judgment, the king separates them. The sheep to the right hand, the goats to the left.
We have to pause on the symbolism of the right hand, because Steve goes deep on this, and I think it's easy to miss.
It's not just a direction. It's a position of status. The right hand is the place of blessing, of honor, of inheritance.
He uses the example of the U.S. flag being placed at the speaker's right.
Or how flags in a parade are dipped in submission to the flag on the right.
But the part that really fascinated me was the Old Testament connection he made. The story of Jacob blessing his grandsons.
Yes. This is a deep cut, but it explains the theology so perfectly. Joseph brings his two sons to his father, Jacob, for a blessing. Manasseh is the older one, so he's on Jacob's right.
And Ephraim, the younger, is on the left. The older brother is supposed to get that right hand blessing the inheritance.
Right. But what does Jacob do? He intentionally crosses his hands.
He switches the blessing. He puts his right hand on the younger son, Ephraim.
And Joseph actually tries to stop him. He says, no, father, this one's the firstborn. But Jacob refuses. He ensures the right hand blessing goes to the one God intended.
It shows that being on the right hand isn't about where you happen to be standing. It's about being the designated heir.
Which brings us to the absolute core of this whole thing, the theological twist. Because if you read Matthew 25 casually.
And I have. 100 times.
You get to verses 35 and 36, and it sounds like a checklist.
I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. It sounds like Jesus is saying, you did a bunch of good stuff. You volunteered. You were a philanthropist, so you get to go to heaven.
That's the common interpretation, the social gospel, the idea that your salvation is the result of your good works. If you're a good person, you're in.
But Brother Steve just slams the brakes on that idea. He points us back to verse 34. He argues that everything hinges on that one sentence.
He does. Let's look at it. The king says, come, you blessed of my father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world.
There are three massive theological points in that one sentence, and they completely dismantle that checklist view.
Okay, so first, that phrase, you blessed of my father. Steve points out the Greek literally translates to my father's blessed ones.
So the reason they're entering the kingdom isn't because they gave someone a sandwich.
Precisely. The entry is because the father blessed them. It emphasizes the source of salvation. It's God's sovereign grace. They are the blessed ones first. The sandwich came later.
And the second point he highlights, and this is my favorite part of the sermon, is the word inherit. This is critical. Think about it. Do you earn an inheritance? No. You earn a wage. If I work 40 hours, I earn a paycheck.
Exactly. An employee works for a wage, but a son inherits. You inherit because of who you are, not what you do. Your family. We are children of God by faith.
That is such a comforting distinction. It takes the pressure off, did I do enough today?
Mm-hmm.
And puts the security on, am I a child of God?
And that leads right into the third point, which solidifies that security. The verse says the kingdom was prepared for you from the foundation of the world.
This is the mind bender.
It implies the selectivity and the security of salvation. God didn't just throw the doors of heaven open and hope someone showed up. He prepared a specific place for specific people, his sheep, before the world even began.
Steve makes a very bold statement here. He says he knows who he has prepared for, and you had nothing to do with it.
That is pure sovereign grace. If God prepared it for you, you will get there. He doesn't save you just to lose you.
So then, how do we explain verses 35 and 36, the feeding and the clothing? If we don't do them to get saved, why do we do them?
Steve explains that those acts are the fruit of the redemption, not the cause. Because you are a sheep, because you have the nature of the shepherd, you naturally do those things.
A goat doesn't act like a sheep.
But a sheep acts like a sheep. You aren't doing them to get in, you're doing them because you're already in.
That clears up the confusion completely.
All right.
It stops being a transaction and starts being a family resemblance.
Exactly. You look like your father.
So we have this heavy teaching on judgment, fire, separation, wrath, but it resolves into this beautiful assurance of grace. And as we wrap up, I'm thinking back to the beginning.
To Sarah Widman in the homicide division.
To the husband on the border. To Cindy Mason falling off the ladder. Why does this theology matter to them? Why does lesson 5 help Sarah get through a shift in Tucson?
Well, it matters because the world is chaotic. It's dangerous. Ladder slip. Crime happens, nations rage. If your hope is based on your own ability to be good enough or to control everything,
yeah,
you're going to be terrified.
Because you can't control it.
You can't. But this message offers a different anchor. The anchor is that if you are one of my father's blessed ones, your future is secure.
It's been prepared since the foundation of the world.
Exactly. So no matter what happens in Tucson or Minneapolis or anywhere else, that inheritance is locked in. And that brings a peace the world cannot give.
But there's also a call to action, right? We don't just sit back and say, okay, cool, I'm safe.
No, absolutely not. Steve ends with a reminder of readiness. The exact moment of his coming is unknown. We see the signs, we know the season, but not the hour. So the call is to be ready now, and not just for ourselves. He asks a piercing question. Do you have family members who need to be ready? That really stuck with me. It brings us back to that missionary aspect. We have this incredible security, but there are people in our lives, maybe like Sarah's husband, who don't have it yet.
And if we believe that judgment is real, that the separation is an actual future event, then love demands that we warn them.
Just like the parent warns the child about the stove.
It really does come full circle back to love.
It does. And I want to leave our listeners with this thought. We get so caught up in the temporal troubles, the bad news, the financial stress, the health scares. But Brother Steve invites us to lift our eyes. There's a kingdom that has been waiting for you since before the stars were made. That is your reality.
The rest of this.
Yeah.
It's just the journey to get there.
That is a powerful place to end. A kingdom prepared from the foundation of the world.
Thank you so much for joining us on this look into Brother Steve's message.
Mm.
We hope it encouraged you to stand firm, stay ready, and keep being salt and light in this dark world.
Amen to that.
We'll catch you next time.